Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Dar Jamayo. He's an award-winning journalist and author who's full-time staff reporter for truthout.org. His most recent book is about abrupt climate change and is called The End of Ice, subtitled Bearing Witness and Finding Meaning in the Path of Climate Disruption. So first, I mean, as I've said many times, as I've written many times, thank you so much for all your great work.
Thanks so much, Derek. That means a lot coming from you.
Oh, thanks. And second, thank you for being on the program. And so can you talk about the reality and the book, The End of Ice?
I've been taking the opportunity of having a lot of public lectures in the wake of this book being published in January to always preface my talks with proper context of how far along we really are, because what I've run into is a pretty wide-scale soft denialism across the left, meaning, of course, everybody understands that the climate crisis is real and that it's amping up and it's very scary and the worst is yet to come. But there is a denialism in that people still think, oh, well, if we do enough, forest restoration and soil restoration and landscape restoration, and if we build solar panels and wind turbines and shift over to a green capitalism, that somehow that's going to help. And I'll preface this by adding that I'm all for working towards mitigation tactics like being kind to the earth and planting more trees and redesignated wildlands and all of that, because it's the moral thing to do no matter what. But this other bit that people are taking into sort of this soft denialism, I think the most egregious examples being the Green New Deal and this IPCC report from last fall saying, oh, we still have 12 years left to avert catastrophic climate impacts, is it's just not correct. The reality is, what I've been reminding people is that we're already in the sixth mass extinction that industrial civilization has caused and is worsening by the day. We're injecting CO2 into the atmosphere at a rate 10 times faster than what occurred even during the Permian mass extinction event 252 million years ago that wiped out 90% of life on Earth. In fact, our current extinction rate is 1,000 times faster than normal and faster than that also of the Permian mass extinction event. This is kind of underscored by that recent report showing that now 1 million more species of plants and animals are at risk of extinction. 2018 was the fourth warmest year ever recorded, the only warmer years being 2015, 2016, and 2017. And we're already in the middle of what is also on track to be the warmest decade since record-keeping began. Furthermore, the oceans have already absorbed a bit more than 93% of all the heat that humans have added to the atmosphere. To give people an idea of how much heat that is, if the oceans had not absorbed it, right now our global atmospheric temperature would be 97 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than it is today. Carbon dioxide levels right now at 415 parts per million are already in accordance with what historically brought about a steady state temperature ranging from 4 to 7 C higher in Earth's geologic history. So, another thing that I point out, which I know that you saw this, maybe we even swapped emails on it, but the reports of what's happening to the insects, of course, just for their own right, obviously, insects need to be, they need to be here and we need them. They don't need us, but we need them. They pollinate roughly 75% of our food, their food for other creatures, and they recycle nutrients into ecosystems. Without them, in short, we're not going to be here for very long. And they are going away. A series of studies show we're losing 2.4% of global insect biomass annually, which means we are on track to lose all insects inside of 100 years. And that's assuming that there's no acceleration, which is a false assumption because one of the leading causes of loss is habitat loss from human expansionism, of course, insecticide use, and then, of course, climate impacts. And I'll just restate something that I know you've talked about a lot, Derek, which is that since just 1970, 60% of all mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles are already gone. And when I share that with people, I like to add the caveat, what would we call it if there had been a 60% reduction in the human population since just 1970? But people don't tend to think about other life forms on the planet in that way. The last things that I like to remind people is that if we could wave a magic wand and stop all fossil fuel drilling and burning and emissions on a dime today, okay, no more CO2 emissions whatsoever, and started doing mitigation impacts like wide-scale forestation projects, reforestation projects, soil regeneration, etc. Just wave our magic wand and do all of this right now. A lot of scientists are already saying that we've got a minimum of 3 degrees C increase of temperature already baked into the system. This is best case scenario. And this is already a catastrophic situation for humans and other life forms. The IPCC's worst case scenario is a 4 to 5 C increase by 2100. We know the IPCC consistently lowballs things and is highly over-conservative and politicized, but that's still catastrophic. Even worse, the International Energy Agency, which represents fossil fuel interests around the world, so not exactly a left-leaning media source here, they stated that preserving our current economic paradigm virtually guarantees a 6C rise in Earth's temperature before 2050, while Shell and BP analysts, also not left-wing media-leaning outlets, expect the globe to be as much as 5C warmer, also by mid-century. So the point is, we are in it, and we're going into it more deeply and intensely than I think most people realize. And I have yet to meet that many people, even in my field, that really, really understand that. I think it's easy to kind of get blinders on and get focused on one part of that and lose sight of the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that the damage is done. We've already caused the insult, the injury to Earth, and we're just waiting for her to continue to show more and more of the signs, you know? And so when we're looking at glacial recession and loss and what's happening to the collapse of the Western Antarctic ice sheet and what's happening in Greenland, both of these places have melting has increased sixfold in the Antarctic since just the 1970s and fivefold in Greenland. So we're just watching this start to ramp up, and we're still at the very, very front end of that, because the thing I'll wrap up with on that overview is that look at everything that's happened to the planet today. We look at the catastrophes, how much seas have already risen, human displacement, species loss, and we've raised the temperature, quote-unquote, only 1.1 C since the Industrial Revolution began. And so I was just talking about, we're looking at potentially a 6C increase by 2050. People need to understand what this really means.
So I'm thinking about, I want to talk about one specific thing you said before we go on to the larger picture. And that's, I'm sure you've noticed in your own life, fewer insects as well. I've lived in the same place for 20 years, and when I first moved here, all winter I would see huge, like dinner plate size, which was huge for me, dinner plate size collections of harvestmen or daddy long legs would gather under eaves and hang out there. And the other day I saw one harvestman, and it was the first harvestman I've seen this year. And the question, and I really want to ask an insect expert about this, but I'm asking you, even though that's not your primary field. This land here, I mean, this land here doesn't have insecticides. It's recovering second growth forest. And I have no doubt that a Daddy Longlegs would not leave this land, would not go to the neighbors. There's enough land here that its range does not extend past. But still, their populations have collapsed. So do you know what is, if it's not habitat loss, which it's not in this case, what is causing insect, and it's also not insecticide in this case, what's causing insect and arthropod, obviously Daddy Longlegs aren't insects, what's causing these arthropod collapses? Or one more example is, it used to be when I would bring in firewood from the garage, every piece I pick up, I would have to check for roly-polies and spiders and insects. And honestly, I don't even bother to check anymore because I see like one a year.
Right, right. Well, the leading causes are habitat loss and insecticide use, which are out of control, and then climate impacts. So if it's too dry for them and seasons are shifting, so their food availability as well as when they mate, all of that is impacted by even the slightest tweaks in the climate. So if we increase the temperature a little bit out of their normal range or decrease it a little bit out of their range, and then that's going to tweak all of their behavior from how they move about to how and when they mate to when they move around. So all of these things are impacted. I mean, just, you know, to give people an idea of how minor these tweaks need to be to cause these huge changes, with the most famous example off the top of my head is the pine bark beetle. They overwinter in the high elevations of mountainous regions, and it traditionally would get cold enough that 99% of them would die overwintering, and then only 1% would last and then come out and kill some trees the next year. Just by changing that 1 degree so that it gets 1 degree warmer in the winter, or a few degrees warmer in the winter, and then that causes, instead of 99% of them dying, only 98% die, look at what the devastation, the tens of millions of acres of forest lost from that one minor tweak. So I'm talking about a very minor tweak there. And then we look, you know, pan back to the context that I just shared at the beginning of the interview. We're talking about sledgehammers that are being brought out against the natural system now, not just minor tweaks.
Okay, thank you for that. And now, you have talked a fair amount, but you haven't actually mentioned the phrase in the book itself, the end of ice. Can you talk, or you did mention the Greenland melting, but there are some feedback systems associated with especially Arctic ice loss. Can you talk about those a little bit? And can you introduce Arctic ice loss and then talk a little bit more about it?
Well, this is a really important aspect of it, and I did choose the title primarily for this reason. The Arctic summer sea ice, well, it's annual, it's there all year round, but it's shrinking dramatically every summer. This past April, it was measured at an all-time record low based on observational evidence, not projections, but observational evidence. If you look at the charts and how fast we're losing it, it's already far, far ahead of the worst case scenario of the so-called IPCC. But based on observational evidence, it looks like we could lose it all within 5 years. And this is a big deal because once that happens, the Earth loses this huge amount of albedo that's, you know, so much of this solar radiation is being reflected back into space as long as that ice is there. Once that's gone, scientific studies have shown estimates of we will gain half a degree C within 10 years once that's gone, just from that alone. That also leaves open the shallow Arctic seas to dramatic and rapid warming, which then is going to be opening us up for the subsea permafrost, which contains methane hydrates, and the methane to be released then, which is a greenhouse gas 85 times more potent than CO2 on a 10-year time scale. That is then in danger of happening very, very rapidly. It's already happening in a minor way in many areas already, which I detail in the book. But this basically sets in motion really some of the nastiest feedback loops. I mean, this is an arguable topic, but certainly I don't think anyone would argue that one of the most dangerous ones is a abrupt methane release across the Arctic, and there's already been studies showing that this is a very, very high possibility of happening. In fact, Natalia Shikova has published this, one of her studies showing that this could literally happen at any time now. So this is, you know, and what's happening in the Arctic is amazing. I mean, it was roughly 2 weeks ago we saw a report in Russia in an area right on the Arctic Circle that had already seen 84 degrees, which was 30 degrees Fahrenheit higher than normal. And these kinds of things, these kinds of reports are coming in all across the Arctic. The Arctic is irrevocably changed. That's even according to NOAA, which, again, not exactly a left-leading scientific outlet there, quite conservative much of the time. And they're even saying, look, it's a completely different region now compared to what it used to be.
And, you know, we talked about the effects of changes on daddy long legs or, you know, various insects. And people, a lot of people are aware of the effects of loss of ice on, for example, polar bears, walruses, seals. But just 2 days ago, I read an account of how a loss of sea ice, I don't remember, a loss of sea ice would also affect the behavior of various fish species who are used to swimming under the ice. I think it's that they will be afraid to come to the surface, and they will not have a refuge there. And of course, there's increasing temperatures are going to change currents. And I guess the point I'm getting at is I've always loved the line by David Ehrenfeld that nature's not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we're capable of thinking. And, you know, we can throw out these terrible scenarios which are happening, but there's also going to be all sorts of ramifications that even if you and I talked about this constantly for 24 hours a day and there was 100 of us talking about it, there are still lots of things that we wouldn't think about. Just it's incredibly complex and it's being messed with. That's all.
I think that's a critically important point, and you know, probably the most important point when we talk about these broad brushstrokes of temperature increases, you know, these just various sledgehammers that we've created that are being whacked against the natural systems on a daily basis from just how much CO2 is already in the atmosphere and how much the oceans have already warmed and been acidified and deoxygenated. And that's, I think, ultimately the scariest part of this whole context of the climate crisis is that all of the science, all of these reports, the 20 pages of citations in my book, all of this, and in the reality, we don't know anything. You know, we know so, so little. I mean, I interviewed Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, the godfather of biodiversity in the science realm, is how some people refer to him, down in the Amazon jungle in Camp 41. And this is a guy who's been studying it diligently since 1965. I mean, literally has dedicated his entire adult life to trying to learn more and protect and conserve the Amazon. And I asked him, like, wow, you know, you've spent your whole life doing this. I mean, this is, we know so much about it. And he just basically cut me off and said, we've barely scratched the surface. You know, we've barely scratched the surface. And this is a guy who, from his one study camp, Camp 41, more than 700 peer-reviewed scientific studies have emerged.
So, you know how much I respect your work, Dar, but I'm going to have to disagree with you on something here.
Go for it.
That's that, you said the scariest thing is that, you know, we don't really know the ramifications. I think we could probably make a list of scariest things. I think one of the scariest things is, I put in the weasel word of one of, I think one of the scariest things is the response by mainstream culture to not merely the large scale denialism, but the ecstasy and lust with which mainstream culture approaches the loss of sea ice as opening up new areas for mining and oil exploration of all things, And I'm sure you've seen the places where people are in all seriousness calling for mining those methyl hydrates. So that scares me, is that as we're flying over the cliff, they are still have their foot on the gas.
Well, you got me there, Derek, because I have to agree with you. Because when I read what, you know, Pompeo talking about keeping climate change out of Arctic reports, I mean, literally the words climate change, and talking about how good it's going to be for shipping and the ability to drill up there, it horrifies me, it sickens me, it enrages me, and it scares the hell out of me. I mean, can you imagine? It's like, you know, the body of the earth is dying and they're just running as fast as they can to some of the last untouched places to try to drill more. I mean, it's absolute insanity. It's like, the worst case scenario in a bad science fiction movie, right? Where we're on the way out probably, and they are falling over themselves, trying to go as fast as they can to speed it up. And they're doing a really good job.
And even the lefties, I mean, the response by the, I mean, mainstream environmentalism has been basically converted into a lobbying arm for the solar and wind industries. And even the, you know, it blows me away that even mainstream sources like the New York Times can have an op-ed about, well, human extinction may be around the corner, but they still can't question. What can be questioned is the continuation of life on the planet. What can't be questioned is the continuation of this way of life. I just find it, I wish that the stakes weren't so high, because then I would find it, terribly ironic. As it is, I just find it horrifying and sad.
That's right. That's right. And I'm having the same experience with it, Derek. It's to the point where it's so hard for me to stay up on the news, and my job requires it, but I've had to literally, disengage as much as I can while still being connected into this information stream, and, have found a very, very fine balance between doing my work and then offsetting it or balancing it with as much time out on the planet as I can. 'Cause like you, I'm fortunate enough to live in a relatively healthy ecosystem. Well, that said, you know, in an area that was entirely clear cut, but is back into some relatively healthy second growth forest, and live nearby a national park that's still in decent shape, aside from all the glaciers melting away. I mean, it's all relative nowadays, but finding ways to go out and just, you know, be with the planet. I mean, that and then hanging out with a select few people who really do understand what's going on and what it takes to kind of stay sane and stay present with this, which is do, as well as remembering our moral obligation that no matter how bleak things appear to be, and they are becoming darker by the day without a doubt, that no matter what, even if we are as a species are on the way out, I still feel deeply morally obliged to still fight for this planet and try to protect what I can and do what I can, for the planet and for future generations of all species.
So long as there exists one wild animal, I guess two wild animals, pair, or one wild plant or one wild fungus, it is incumbent upon us to continue to fight for them.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more.
Oh, thanks. But before we, I do want to really dive into that, but there's one more thing that I want to talk about before we follow the natural transition that you'd already set up, which is, is it accurate that every major mass extinction in the past on this planet has involved somewhat abrupt climate change? And I'm pretty sure, I don't remember which one it was, but one or two of them had to do with the release of the methyl hydrates, if I recollect. I think there was one that there was a huge series of volcanoes that the the lava flow ran into an ocean that had the metal hydrates on the base, and that by itself caused mass extinction. Am I remembering correctly that most of them did involve abrupt climate change?
Well, close. The one you're referencing was actually the Permian mass extinction, which was the biggest so far until clearly what this one's going to be. And it involved a massive amount of volcanism across the Siberian traps that over thousands of years released enough CO2 into the atmosphere that it warmed the atmosphere to the point where then ice in the Arctic melted and released the methane hydrates. So we've essentially replicated that model, but on a extremely rapid time scale. That entire event that released all the methane took place over 80,000 years. We're doing it in 250 and counting. So that gives you an idea of the intense speed with which we've managed to pull this off. But the other primary commonality between, I think all, there might be one that we would set aside, but I'll be safe and say most of the mass extinction events, the commonality shared was a massive amount of CO2 released into the atmosphere that warmed the planet, and then all hell broke loose.
And I will point out that over that 80,000 years, the species on the planet did not have to deal with highways blocking their way. They didn't have to deal with endocrine disruptors. They didn't have to deal with plastics. They didn't have to deal with, I mean, basically all, in quotes, they had to deal with was abrupt climate change and various changes in composition of the atmosphere. They didn't also have to deal with habitat destruction caused by bulldozers.
Very important point, right, which is another reason why this one is moving along so much faster for all the other species, both on land and in the ocean. Because in the ocean, I mean, and gosh, that was one of the first things I think I heard in one of your public talks, you know, a couple of decades ago when I became aware of your work of, you know, that, you know, 90% of all the large fish in the ocean are gone. And that's primarily because of fishing. And now, of course, plastics and all the rest, but just fishing and hunting and habitat loss and all of that alone is exactly right. And that's another reason why this is going so breathtakingly fast. So in a human time scale, yeah, it's still taking years, but on a geologic time scale, and that's where, you know, you start looking at these historic graphs of CO2 patterns in the atmosphere that go back 800,000 years based on Antarctic ice cores. And what we've done, you know, there have been these huge cycles and waves over time. And in comparison, our era of CO2 emissions, the graph's straight up, and it's just off the charts, literally. And it's just mind-bending to look at the literally geologic level changes we've caused to the planet on just a human time scale. It's actually quite the feat that has been pulled off.
Yeah, I find it, I said this in one book or another, that I think that the most significant human accomplishment by civilized humans is not putting a man on the moon, is not modern science or modern medicine, it's not any of those. It's that they have essentially killed the oceans. I mean, that's an extraordinary feat.
That's right. That's right. I mean, considering that they cover 70% of the surface of the planet and that we've mapped more of the moon than we have the deep oceans.
So having, one hopes, brought the listeners to tears or to something, to grim resolution perhaps, what now?
Well, I'd like to, I'm going to actually share a short bit out of my book where I quote Stephen Jenkinson, who he brings a lot to the table as far as challenging Western culture's phobia around death and unwillingness to look at things as they really are. He's an author and storyteller from Canada. He worked in the palliative care industry for decades. And since pulled himself out of that, and he goes around talking to people about, well, basically what's really important, especially at this stage in the crisis. And he has some great quotes from a talk that he gave at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver a ways back, where he was talking about dealing with the climate crisis. And he says, the question is not, are we going to fail? The question is how. The question is, what shall be the manner of our inability to care for what was entrusted to us? The question is our manner of failing. And he, when he talks about our failure to care for what was entrusted to us, he goes on to say, grief requires us to know the time we are in. The great enemy of grief is hope. Hope is the four-letter word for people who are willing to know things for what they are. Our time requires us to be hope-free, to burn through the false choice of being hopeful and hopeless. He calls those as being two sides of the same con job. And he says that grief is required to proceed. And I'm not advocating that we sit around and navel gaze and dive into our grief and spend too much time there. But I think it's important to do enough of that to really take in the impact emotionally, spiritually, and psychologically of what it means to be alive in this time and really feel that in our bodies and get that and process through all of that. And I can't do it without doing it with other people of really talking and digging into this, because only by getting in my body and really feeling what it means to be on a planet that's this wounded and possibly even seeing within even our lifetimes, possibly, if not a little bit longer than that, possibly even the extinction of our own species. And only from that point can I really know that my feet are on the ground of reality. And then am I in a position to really, really go out and start behaving accordingly. Because I've had people question me sessions of my talks and sometimes accuse me of, oh, you're advocating that it's just over. So what's the point? Why do anything? And I think that if I really get deeply in my body, what it really means to be on the planet at this time, given everything that's occurred that we just discussed and is ongoing, then in fact, I am more compelled than ever to work harder than ever to try to save what is still left. Damn the consequences, damn being attached to whatever the results of those actions are, because they're probably going to fail. But we have nothing to lose. And I think it's actually a time where radicalism now is an imperative for all of us.
Well, thank you for that. And I can't tell you how much I agree. And also, I mean, I find myself terribly frustrated by the response that when you say how bad things are, people say, well, so let's just party, or let's just, I guess that means we should just eat, drink, and be merry. Or it's like, no, if your response is that we should eat, drink, and be merry, or even that we should merely mourn, what that reveals is a lack of love. Because and what I always say is, if there was a serial killer who was taking members of your family out and killing them in the next room, you wouldn't be going, well, okay, so my turn's going to come in a while, so I guess I should just have some potato chips and because I really like potato chips. No, what you do instead is you figure out what you're going to do. And it's the same with, you know, I think sometimes about Schindler's List and how, you know, he couldn't save them all, but he can save what he can.
Right.
And then two more things. One of them is, I'm thinking about two things that my dear friend John Osborne, I know that this is something we shouldn't talk about on the radio, but do you know John? Have you met?
I do not.
Okay. You and John should meet. He's wonderful. He was my mentor. He's how I got into environmentalism. Anyway, John Osborne is a doctor. Basically, he's an emergency room doctor by day and an environmentalist by night. And he brings the medical model to it. And he says that correct diagnosis is the first step toward proper treatment. And I think about that with your work, that if we're not doing a correct diagnosis, how can we figure out what the proper treatment is? Which is how we end up with, solar panels to solve this problem, because they don't have the correct diagnosis. So I'll just stop with him and I'll go back to him in a second. But so do you want to respond to that?
I think that's brilliant. I love that analogy. It's absolutely perfect. So, you know, we can run around treating all these symptoms and we're not even looking at what's causing them. I absolutely love that. And another thing that I'll just throw in there is, you know, I quote often Vaclav Havel. He challenges the whole idea of hope, which I see as an externalizing of our own agency. And Havel says, hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something is doing no matter how it turns out. And I keep coming back to that because I see so many people that are so attached to the outcomes to the point of paralysis where almost a lack of engagement if they don't think it's going to make a difference. Well, it's definitely not going to make a difference if you don't go out there and try.
Well, that leads directly to the other quote by John, which is that he often says that when you ask him why he's doing the work he does, he often says, as things become increasingly chaotic, I want to try to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is if bull trout are gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. But if they're here in 10 years, they may be here in 12, and they may be here in 20. And if that second growth forest where you live or the second growth forest where I live is here in 10 years, if it's gone, it's gone in all realistic terms forever. But if it's here in 10 years, who knows if this might be a place that redwoods can continue to spread. We don't know. And so as things become increasingly horrid, that makes it all the more imperative to save every scrap of wild land, it seems.
Absolutely right, Derek. And that's, you know, I've run into odds with people. I've come to odds with some of the folks who absolutely believe no matter what, humans are on the way out. And I'll be the first to say it certainly appears as though that's the case. But I personally feel like I need to exercise enough humility, and this is going back to what we said towards the beginning of our conversation of we have no idea even the complexity of nature and how everything even works. So we don't know. We can't say for sure that humans are on the way out, you know, full stop. We just don't know. It certainly appears that way today, possibly even much sooner rather than later. But again, we have to just keep fighting. We have to keep protecting. Holding actions have their place because if we can just keep buying time for things that are still here, at least it gives it a chance. And again, for me, that I just keep coming back to that moral obligation. Every time I get completely depressed, want to throw my hands up, yet another massive study comes out that shows, oh, now we're twice as far along as we thought we were in this regard, et cetera, then I have to just keep coming back to that moral obligation that, you know, I was born onto this planet with an obligation to protect and serve the Earth, no matter what that looks like.
Well, thank you for that. And this reminds me also of something. I had a conversation with somebody from the Buckeye Forest Council back 12, 13 years ago. And he was telling me about a conversation he'd had with a Forest Service timber sale planner. And the timber sale planner said, you know, we keep putting out these timber sales. You keep stopping them. But one of these years, we're going to get it past you, and then we're going to clear cut it. So why are you bothering? And he said to the guy immediately, because in the meantime, there are several generations of butterflies that you can't kill. And I think about that, too. And, of course, that is not sufficient for me to make it so that a few more generations of lampreys or coho salmon survive. That's not sufficient, but it is necessary. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I do, absolutely. I mean, it's just another way, I think, of using a real-life example to kind of underscore the point that we don't know. We can't go into the decision on whether or not to take an action based on what we think the results may or may not be. Again, I think that's kind of the same arrogance and anthropocentrism that got us to this point in the first place as a species, as an industrialized part of the species, that is, of that, hey, yeah, I think I can predict the future. So if I do X, I'm going to get Y. And that is the antithesis of how, you know, our nature even works. And so it's incumbent upon us as being of the planet and part of it and from it to put everything we have into protecting what is left.
I loved The End of Ice. And I have to tell you, I thought my favorite part was your last three or four pages. So, and we have, I don't know, probably, we have probably 10 minutes left. So would you rather, I'm going to give you three choices. Would you rather read the last couple pages? Would you rather talk about what you talk about in the last couple pages? Or would you rather answer the question of pretend that I am asking you, pretend I'm hearing all this for the first time and I say to you, well, I don't know what to do. What should I do specifically? Tell me what to do. So take it whatever one of those three you want to do.
I think I'm going to do a little bit of a mix. I am going to share from the last few pages. There's a story that has helped me a whole lot, both in understanding of what's happening as well as a good way to respond to it. And so I'm going to read about a page of that first. And it was a story that was told to me by a Native American elder of Cherokee descent named Stan Rushworth. And it was shared with him, or to him, by his elder, Dr. Darrell Wilson, from the Pitt River Nation of northeastern California, not too far from you. And Wilson tells of Mis Misa, a small but powerful spirit that inhabits Akuyet, what white people call Mount Shasta. Mis Misa is a spirit force that balances the earth with the universe and the universe with the earth. Wilson says that Akuyet is the most necessary of all of the mountains upon earth because Mis Misa keeps the earth the proper distance from the sun and keeps everything in its proper place when wonder and power stir the universe with a giant yet invisible canoe paddle. Mis Misa keeps the earth from wandering away from the rest of the universe. It maintains the proper seasons and the proper atmosphere for life to flourish as Earth changes seasons on its journey around the sun. The mountain, the story goes on, must be worshipped because Mis Misa dwells deep within it. To climb the mountain with a pure heart and with real resolve and to communicate with, quote, all of the light and all of the darkness of the universe is to place your spirit in a direct line from the songs of Mis Misa to the heart of the universe. While in this posture, the spirit of man slash woman is in perfect balance and harmony, end quote. For as long as Mis Misa's instructions are followed with sincerity, society will be sustained. Its inhabitants will survive for the long term. Quote, the most important of all of the lessons, it is said, is to be so quiet in your being that you constantly hear the soft singing of Mis Misa, end quote. However, the story also warns that by not listening to Mis Misa's song, the song will fade. Mis Misa will depart, and the earth and all of the societies upon earth will be out of balance, and the life therein vulnerable to extinction. And so that is why when I heard that story, that's when I learned, oh, this is why I've always felt deeply inside of myself to be drawn up into the mountains ever since I was a little kid, even growing up in Texas, which made no sense whatsoever. Texas isn't exactly known for its beautiful mountainscapes, but I became enraptured by them the first time I saw a picture of one in a book and literally have oriented my entire adult life around living in or nearby mountain ranges and continue to go up into them to seek solace and to listen. So I learned that's where I go to listen to Mis Misa, and that's where this book was born, from me being up in mountains listening to Mis Misa. So when I go around talking about the book, I try to remind people to do that by asking them, where do you go to listen to Mis Misa, and when was the last time that you went there? Because I feel like right now is a time we need to go to wherever that place is and listen as deeply and intently as possible, and the answers are going to come if we're really listening in the right way. The answers of the question of what in God's name should I do during this time? What should I do? How should I behave? What's really, really important, and what risks am I willing to take to protect what's left?
So that would be a beautiful place to end, but I'm going to ask a really naive and kind of stupid question, which is, well, that's all nice, Dar, but what do you want me to do? Which I'm sure you get too.
Well, and that's why literally on the last page of the book, I brought in another story that, Stan Rushworth, who I mentioned earlier, shared with me, and he teaches, critical thinking and indigenous literature, Native American literature at, Cabrillo College in Aptos, California. And he periodically will bring in various Native American elders to talk to his class. And, he shares a story where he brought in, Henry Tyler, an Arapaho elder, and after sharing a whole bunch of pretty intense information about the Native American genocide and other things, someone in the class inevitably would ask him, what do we do? And he would just stop and be totally silent. And then he would point to his head and say, use this. And it was because everything that he had said for the previous 3 hours of speaking to the class was there in people's minds and provided the same tools that they would need in order to respond correctly. The other way I would underscore this is Stan shared another story of a man named CeeLo Black Crow, who's a Lakota Sundance leader and elder, who would tell people, quote, think about it. That's up to you. I can't tell you what to do. Educate yourself, and then you decide. And so of that, Rushworth told me that, like listening to Uncle Henry, listening to him for 3 hours would give an incalculable amount of information and food for reflection. But the point is, and what Stan told me he thinks, it's critical that people think for themselves and come fully into their own agency, and only from that place make the decisions on the proper course of action. Because if it's not from within you, from the earth, and then from within you, when times get tough and you feel like quitting, I think we would just simply lack the conviction to continue. And that's why I keep going back to the Mies Mises story, because if we go out there and we get really quiet and we get that transmission, and we will get it if we listen intently enough, then we're going to be moved to follow that for however long and however far we need to go. I mean, that's where I got the transmission to do the book. And now I'm 4 years into this project of, you know, the research, the writing, the field trips, and then now on tour with it. And it's going to go on for probably another year. And that came from the earth, not from me. And whatever I do next is going to come the same way. And I have no idea what that's going to be, but I'm sure I'm going to get the transmission because I know how to listen the right way. So I'm just really encouraging people, don't listen to me, don't listen to Derek Jensen. Go out there to the earth, the place most important to you, and ask the question, what can I do for the earth? How can I best be used to serve the earth? And then just listen. And if you listen the right way, you're going to hear, and then you're going to get very, very busy.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for all of your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Dar Jamail. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.